Today I'm here in St Kilda and I'm talking to writer Adrian McKinty, and I'm very pleased to be back in St Kilda because this is where I lived first when I came to Melbourne. Interesting place to be. Thank you, Adrian, for giving us your time.
It's great to be here.
Now, you've written, I believe, 16 books in all. I wanted to talk to you particularly about your fourth Sean Duffy novel, Sean Duffy, so you've been writing about him for four books. You must know him pretty well.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about him for us?
Absolutely. It's a character that I've fallen in love with over the series of the books. About 3 or 4 years ago, when I thought of the first one, I thought to myself, I've got this idea for a character, for a Catholic policeman in Northern Ireland in the 1980s, and the initial concept came because I wanted to write about the 1980s in general. I thought, you know, here I am, and I'm a crime writer and a mystery novelist, and I've written about Denver, I've written about New York, I've written about London, but I've never written about this place that I grew up in, Belfast, in the 70s and 80s. So I thought to myself, okay, I want to do something. So I had the setting first, and then I thought to myself, okay, who would be an ideal guide for the readers? Says it's got to be an outsider. And I thought, what if I put a Catholic policeman in a Protestant housing estate, and they hate him because he's Catholic, and they hate him because he's a policeman, and a Catholic policeman, even his fellow coppers aren't going to trust him. So I thought to myself, that is just going to be delicious, all those fracture lines and bits of friction and bits of tension there. And so I thought, I really got the thought a lot about that, and then I thought, oh my God, what if I put him in the house where I was born and grew up? I'll put him in my house on my street with all my neighbors, and I'll make him, and I knew I wanted to have him a Catholic, I knew I wanted to have a policeman, and I thought, how else can I annoy those people in that street? And I thought, I know, I'll make him quite well educated. You know, he was doing a PhD before he quit and joined the cops, and I'll make him a bohemian, and you know, so I'll make him have this eclectic music taste and eclectic taste in fiction. Yeah. And that'll really get on their nerves, and it'll just be plenty of grist for the mill. So he's a Catholic, he's a policeman, he's bohemian, he comes from a different part of Northern Ireland, and you know, he's a little bit more educated than the people around him. So I thought, that's just going to be absolutely delicious and really fun to play with.
Sounds like you want to make him suffer. I mean,
yeah,
I thought you liked him.
I wanted to make him suffer, and I also wanted his neighbors to suffer as well. And then I thought, and maybe there'll be a gradual acceptance from both him of them and them of him. And that'll be plenty of material for me to work with.
So what interested me too was the Sean Duffy of Gun Street Girl, the latest Sean Duffy novel. He must be a different character to the character of Cold Ground. How do you make him change and evolve?
Well, I wanted the character to go through a definitive arc. I wanted him in the Cold Ground, I wanted him to be pretty optimistic, pretty young. I wanted to give him the feeling that he could make a difference. That's why he joins the police in the first place. He wants to make a difference and really try and help. And then I want him to become increasingly jaded and cynical and pessimistic as the books go on. I really wanted the character to grow. And then I thought, I think in this fourth book, I really wanted big changes for the character. And I thought, I want to take him right to the breaking point, give him as many dependency issues as I could, and really stretch him to see if he cracks, to see if he lives or dies, and just to see as far as that character can possibly go. And that was really interesting for me to do that.
Yeah. Now, what interests me about the character is described as having a smart mouth. Now, I laughed a lot in this book. I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to, but I couldn't help laughing. He's got the smart line, and you know, the sort of a dialogue is so funny. What interested me was, is that the advantage of fiction, that you can sort of make up the funny lines sort of after the fact rather than, you know, sometimes you're in a situation and you think, oh, I wish I'd have thought of that funny line, you know, two hours ago when I was in the situation.
I'm not a quick wit. I mean, I'm one
of those. He is.
I know. I'm one of those people.
He's very funny.
I'm one of those people at the party where on the way home in the taxi,
that's what I mean.
God, I should have said that.
That's right. Yeah. How smart.
That bastard who was pontificating about X, if I only had come in with that bit of information that I knew, or if I'd said that, I really could have nailed him. I'm not that person who thinks like that at all. But one of the things that has always annoyed me, it's driven me absolutely mental about fiction and about especially films about the Troubles, is that they're also bloody dreary.
Yeah.
I mean, if you watch any film about the Troubles, it's always, they play that awful music, that violin music or the cellos, and it's always weeping women, and they're just going, oh, they've come for our Billy, oh, what are we going to do? And the rain's always falling, and they're always so depressing. And there certainly was that aspect of life in the Troubles, but that's not the way I remember it at all. I remember it, people surviving with this really, really dark sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, there would be atrocities, there'd be terrible things going on, there'd be bomb scares, there'd be actual bombs. And I remember people being really, really funny. Like, I remember my dad worked in Harlan Wolf in the shipyard that built the Titanic. And, you know, it's always a big cause of shame for the Titanic workers, you know, that they built this ship. The most famous ship that they built, you know, sunk on its maiden voyage and like 2,000 people drowned. And, you know, if you'd ever talk to somebody from Harlan Wolf, they'll always say with a very black sense of humor, well, it was okay when it left us. You know, and that's the thing. People have a very, very dark sense of humor. And it's never picked up by, especially when English directors go and make a film about the Troubles.
Yeah.
They have no idea that people are making fun of them.
Mm.
And they're being very, very darkly sarcastic and ironic and dour.
Yeah.
And it's just because the sense of humor in Belfast is incredibly deadpan and incredibly dark and funny. Mm. And I thought, the one thing I'm going to accomplish with these books is that I'm going to make people, from now on, they're going to appreciate that people were dark and people were funny, and that has to be. And you, I just, you know, they made a film called 71.
Oh, yes.
It just came out. It was an excellent film, and there was nobody, you know, grinding an axe. And there was none of that stuff in it. But again, I thought to myself, well, where's the darkness? Where's the funny? Where's the sarcasm? And just the way I remember it in the 70s and 80s is that people were very funny, and that hasn't been captured anywhere.
Yeah. There was a couple of phrases, well, a couple, there were many, but a couple that I picked out. You talked about Coke was like getting yelled at by God. Now, you know, if I could have come up with a phrase like that, I would have just been so happy. And describing a woman with nails like those of an itinerant sheet metal worker. Very, very funny.
Yeah, I had real fun with that scene in the church, in the church social.
Yeah.
I thought this is going to be, again, another opportunity for torturing Duffy, to put him in this really embarrassing,
he's very uncomfortable, isn't he?
Uncomfortable situation. And because I've been in situations like that. I remember once I went to like a church dance when I was like 16 or 17 years old, and they were playing Acker Bilk on the, and I thought, oh my God, it's music from the 1940s. What the hell am I doing here? And I thought, I really wanted to put Duffy in that situation and see what happened. So that was very enjoyable for me to do.
Get that. So how vernacular was the dialect in Gun Street Girl? There was a few things, like one phrase that I thought particularly, life expectancy was measured in dog years. Those sort of phrases, is it very vernacular to the area, or something you made up?
I've actually had to tone that down. I mean, if I had really gone full tilt with the you know, the vernacular and the patois of Belfast, it would have been almost incomprehensible.
So we wouldn't have got it,
For anybody outside, you know, not even anybody outside Ireland, it'd be basically anybody outside Belfast area.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even people down south have trouble understanding people in Belfast when they're talking full dialogue, in full tilt slang and full tilt accent. So for me, I had to tone a lot of that down, but I needed to bring enough back in to get you the flavor. Have you ever read James Kelman?
No,
he's the Glaswegian novelist. Mm. He won the Booker Prize with How Late It Was, How Late.
Mm.
And I thought that was a very he's a very bold, brave writer, because he just does, well, this is the way people speak, and I'm just going to give it to you. But his books are a real slog. I mean, it's very, very hard, and I admire his authenticity. But I thought to myself, I can't do that with a crime novel.
And your publisher might have let you get away with it either.
I don't think the publisher would have let me get away with it. They would have said, look, you've got to bring... And one of the things people do in Belfast is that after every sentence, they'll say, so it is... when English gets translated into Irish, there's this little phrase in Irish which comes back in English as this modifier, and so people will say that standard conversation, it's raining, so it is, and or I was late, so it was, or it's a nice day, so it is. Now that happens. That's the way people talk, and if I'd put that in the book, it would have been so tedious to read. So I can only do a flavour of that, you know, two or three times a chapter, or once a page, or whatever.
But it certainly comes across.
Yeah, you try. But, you try and give flavour, but if you can't make it too much.
And I wanted to ask you too about the style, and I might just read something from one of the pages of what I'd call like a staccato shorthand. Percussive sort of style that comes out sometimes. I'll just read this bit just to in chapter 18, home, bed, sleep on the sofa, awake at 4 a.m, car alarm going on the BMW, grab my revolver, outside into the freezing rain, coming down the buckets, something wrong with the car, closer look. All these short sentences, I wondered, are the shorts, is it to sort of get through some of the stuff that's not so interesting to get to the interesting stuff, or what's with these really short scenes? It's almost like, oh, look, I can't be bothered with this. I want to get through this stuff and get to the interesting stuff.
There's two things going on there. Elmer Leonard, he said when he was writing a novel that he writes fiction without the boring bits, life without the boring bits. And when he's doing fiction, he, you know, and he wanted to do that. And I thought to myself, for years I thought that was a good idea, and I thought, well, if you're going to do it, just do it without the boring bits. And then I thought, but actually some of the best things I've read is actually the boring bits, and I quite enjoy the boring bits. If somebody's just sitting looking out a window and you get their thoughts on stuff, and the stuff where it's not always forward in the momentum of the story. I've actually kind of liked the boring bits sometimes, and in passages in the books, I'll go off on like a tangent for two or three pages and just write about what I want to write about. You know, it's not necessarily part of the story. And then I thought to myself, there's the James Ellroy approach. I don't know if you've read The Cold 6000.
No.
Well, he wrote this book called American Tabloid, and he wrote this book called The Cold 6000, and that was the apogee of that Ellroy style, where he basically does 650 pages of verbal sentences, and it's just a collection of nouns, and that's almost like a work of art. You know, he's just decided, I've written a crime novel as a work of art, as this bizarre, strange poem, which I love, and so I've sort of incorporated those two ideas from Elmore Leonard and from James Ellroy.
Okay.
That sometimes in the book, if there's a scene that I want to describe, I'll just do it the Elmore Leonard way, which is, this is a boring bit, and I can either do two things here. I can unpack it and really explore it for like three pages, just to say the hell with it, or I can condense it into a paragraph and go the Ellroy way, just nouns, verbs, get through it, and do it like that. And so I like exploring different prose styles and different approaches.
So it's the whim of the writer at the time, is it? You just decide
this is
worth exploring or this isn't.
Yeah, and it really is. Yeah. And sometimes I'll go and rewrite the scene. I mean, sometimes I'll have like a four-page scene, which I've done this a lot, and I'll read the four-page scene and just go, you know what? I'm just going to cut this whole thing down to three sentences.
Yeah.
And I'll just do that. Or sometimes I've got these three sentences, and I thought, you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to make a page and a half on this. And that's been known to drive my editor crazy. And she'll say, well, hold on. Wait, this major plot point that you dealt with in one paragraph? And this bit, he's making a cup of tea, you spent a page on that? What the hell were you thinking? Yeah, what were you thinking? I just go, well, that's the way I wanted to go with it, you know? Yeah. And it's good to do it that way, because you can subvert your reader's expectations a little bit.
It is a subversion, yeah. You think, what's going on here?
Yeah, there's a bit in No Country for Old Men. I took my breath away when I read it, where Cormac McCarthy kills his main character off screen.
Yes.
And you followed this guy's tribulations and trials through 180 pages, and then you turn a chapter and just go, and you find out that he died off screen. you know, in the interstitial breaks between the chapters. And I thought myself, I would never do that because I don't have the nerve to do that. But my God, what a bold choice that is. Like, I mean, anybody else would have spent at least a chapter on this death scene of this main character. And he just goes, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to mess with your heads, readers. I'm going to kill. That must have annoyed so many people. And I was very, very keen to see how they were going to do that when the Coen brothers directed the film.
Yes,
and they did it.
They did that too, didn't they?
Same way.
Yeah, they did. They
killed him off screen. And I'm sure everybody was watching just go, what? Are you allowed to do that?
What happened? Where'd you go?
Is that permissible? And it is permissible.
So anything's permissible.
So I've never done that.
No.
But I was so impressed, and I so shocked and impressed.
So you might, by the sound of it.
I would love to do it. I just don't think I have the nerve.
No.
I just don't. But I mean, for instance, I've thought about killing Duffy, and I've thought about killing him in a really, really stupid way.
Yeah.
Because he always checks under his car.
Yeah.
He always. But wouldn't it be interesting if he's crossing the road and he slips in the rain and just gets hit by a bus? I would really annoy
like
the readers.
A clue.
The hate mail that I would get.
You would
just be fantastic. I wrote this book called Falling Glass a few years ago, and I decided that from the very beginning, I had this ending in mind where I would have these two characters meet, and I would have them had two opposing viewpoints, and I would have these two viewpoints argue, and if one convinced the other, he wouldn't be killed, and if he didn't convince the other, he would be killed. And I thought, I've brought all these elements together like a symphony right at the very end, and I'm just going to leave it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take myself out of the book, and I'm not going to tell the reader how it resolved itself.
Yes.
And it says, your reader has to decide which of these arguments is the most convincing, and they have to impose the ending for themselves.
Yeah.
I got so much hate mail
not worth it.
For that ending.
Yeah.
Just hundreds of people wrote to me, just like, well, what happens? And I had to write all these letters back, well, you have to decide that for yourself. And people were just going, no, we want you to tell us what happened. But I don't know. Some days I think this happened, some days I think this happened. You know, that just made people furious.
I bet.
So I don't know if I'd do that again.
Now, the other element that's interesting in the Duffy stories is the music. There's music everywhere. Sometimes it's even classical music. I was thinking, when your books are made into films, you know, it'll be very easy for them to choose soundtracks because the music's everywhere.
Yeah, it might cost them a fortune, though, because the Rolling Stones charge
instead
of the Beatles.
Yeah, so they might have to rewrite.
Yeah.
So why is that music so important? Is it your choice, or is it Duffy's choice?
It was me.
It's everywhere.
For me, the soundtrack of my life from my childhood in the 70s and 80s, just this music was everywhere.
Yeah.
People were singing on the street. You know, there were street musicians. People were playing music. Music was playing on the radio. Just music was a huge part of it. People played music. I mean, everybody learned the piano or a fiddle, or like my brothers and sisters were always like practicing. My brother had a trombone. One of my sisters was on the viola. Another one was on the violin.
Yeah, what about you?
I gave up the piano. They forced me to do piano lessons, and I said, I'm not having that. So I gave up on the piano. Later, I took up the guitar. But just everywhere, it was just music was a big part of the life. And I thought, this is another really important part of the culture which doesn't really get much play, especially again in those Troubles movies where they do this faux Irish music in the background, this melancholy faux Irish music which just annoys me so much. And so I thought, well, you know, I've got to put what people were really listening to. And I also like the fact, again, this was another way of annoying Duffy. He grows up in the 60s and 70s, this era of really amazing music, English Invasion stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he grew up with the Kinks and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's also really into soul music and R&B. And the 70s is this high point of all this stuff. And then the 70s gets this little boost in 1977 with the invention of punk. And so all this amazing stuff comes over from New York, the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and all that stuff. And so Duffy's just in heaven. And also the 70s, I don't know if you remember this, it's the hi-fi revolution, and all these high-fidelity classical recordings are coming through, which you could never get before. Yes. So Duffy could hear, like, if he wants to hear an obscure Haydn symphony, it's easy to get it. And it was also the era that you never see it anymore, of record shops, you know, where you could go in and they had those little booths where you could listen to records, you know, like YouTube today. Yeah. And so this is this golden era. And then I love the fact that in the 1980s, Duffy's getting depressed because, you know, 1980s is this when Kylie and starts to sing in Stock Aitken and Waterman with those guys who started doing all those like synth pop stuff in the 80s. And in the 80s, the music is just terrible. And Duffy, I love the Smiths, but Duffy hates the Smiths, and he hates, you know, Spandau Ballet, and he hates all the stuff at the top of the charts. And so I thought this would be a really good way of antagonizing. You know, he's got all these highfalutin musical tastes, and on the radio, all he can hear is, you know, Bross and Spandau Ballet, and, who was the one at the start of Gun Street Girl? Give me the book. What does it say at the beginning? Number one album is what? It's Jennifer Rush is the Power of Love. Remember that song?
Yes, yes.
It was the top of the charts for like 12 weeks. And I can just imagine poor Duffy turning on the radio, and every time he hears
it. You really like to annoy him, don't you?
Yeah, dude. I can just imagine him turning on the radio, and every time he hears it, he's just, his knuckles are getting white, and he wants to crash the car. Because it's just driving him crazy. I really wanted to capture a lot of those different ideas.
So it sounds like Duffy's still very much part of you. Is there a future for Duffy, do you think?
I don't know. I really don't know about that, because at the end of the third book, I thought, well, that's it. I really liked the way book three ended.
Yeah.
I had this sort of really interesting ending, for me anyway, where they sort of look into the future, and so I thought, well, that's it. I've really explored that character. And the only reason I wrote the fourth book was because I thought of an ending, and I really liked the ending.
Mm.
Do you remember the chapter about the crow and the helicopter?
Yeah. Yes.
And I wrote that first. I wrote that chapter first before anything else, and I thought, well, that's a good ending.
Yeah.
But I don't have a novel there.
Pity about that.
Yeah, and then I thought about this idea about maybe, like, I think it was like David Cameron was in the news a lot, and I thought, well, what if David Cameron was at this party at Oxford in the 1980s, and he got away with ejecting this girl with heroin, and I thought, well, better not make it the real David Cameron.
Otherwise, this point.
Otherwise, I could get in big trouble with her. But what if I had a David Cameron-esque figure in the Bullingdon Club?
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's only an element of a bigger story.
Mm.
And so I sort of thinking about it, and then I remembered Oliver North and the Iran for Contra thing, and I said, ooh, maybe it could be part of that.
Yeah.
And so it sort of had the elements, and I'd written that ending, and I thought, yeah, that would be a good arc.
Yeah.
And then I could have a pretty strong definitive ending where Duffy's potential love life and his potential other career all just end with this actual real incident, real tragedy, actually. When they, for whatever reasons, they put the top 20 MI5 agents in one helicopter, and then flew them into a mountain. Amazing, really, that they thought of doing that. And what a disaster for.
So I wanted to ask you about that too, about the historical stuff, because, you know, there's a real historical base, historical events to all the Duffy stories. That interplay between that historical, I mean, Margaret Thatcher comes into, I forget which book.
The third one, she's in.
Yeah, and what you've just said about, you know, the North and all that historical stuff. How does that sort of play into the fiction stuff? And then how do you put them together? Does one come first, or?
That's a good question.
And why had the historical stuff? What if you just made it all up?
Well, I like having the historical stuff as a skeleton. And then you can play with it, and you can subvert it,
which
I like having that skeleton there. And I thought, well, this is the box, and then I can play as much as I like within the box, and sort of, you know, fake the rest of the story. So I do like that. I do like that, having the historical structure, and then being able to play within the structure.
Yeah.
But I'm not that wedded to the truth. I mean, I don't. it's a novel. I mean, if I wanted to have an army of zombies walking down the street, I could do that, because it's...
I think I read somewhere, was it on your blog, how somebody took you to task about some detail or other, and I think your reply was something about, well, this is Duffy's world. It's a real world for Duffy, and whether it's the real world or not, it's beside the point.
Yeah, I mean, I strongly believe that. I mean, a couple of people have written to me, like one of the... I remember I wrote this book called, I think it was I Hear the Sirens in the Street. And for the purposes of a joke, I had Gurkha soldiers stop Duffy at a checkpoint. And Duffy, there were checkpoints all over Northern Ireland, and you were always stopped by troops of the regular British Army. And this guy wrote to me and he said, look, there were never Gurkhas posted to Northern Ireland. And I wrote back and I said, well, look, this was just for the purposes of a joke. I think it was a joke about... the Gurkhas are Hindus, and it was an exploration of, you know, how weird it must be for a Hindu to be in Northern Ireland with all these crazy Protestants and all these crazy Catholics fighting each other, and he's wondering what incarnation he did in the previous life to send him here. And I said, so I'm well aware that there were no Gurkhas in Northern Ireland, but I did it for the joke. He says, however, if it helps you appreciate or read the book in a different way, you can consider it as, this is what really happened in Duffy's universe. In Duffy's universe, what really happened is that they withdrew soldiers from the parachute regiment and sent them to the Falklands. And to make up the gap, they sent in, because Duffy doesn't exist. I mean, he didn't live in that house at that time. I was living there. And none of the people in Duffy's police station existed. None of these people exist. So it's a completely fictional universe. And so if that will help you get over that fact that you consider a mistake, just consider, well, that's what really happened in Duffy's universe. And I think that's a way of doing that.
Maybe it's the mentality of the people reading. I mean, they expect that sort of accuracy, or they're used to reading that sort of, you know.
Well, I don't have a lot of... I don't have a lot of sympathy with the view that things have to be 100% accurate in fiction. I mean, Werner Herzog, the film director, talks about this concept in his documentaries called Ecstatic Truth. And he said, look, my documentaries aren't necessarily true. Everything in them isn't 100% true. I've staged some things, I've reshot some things. And he says, but what I try to capture is this concept of ecstatic truth, this emotional truth. And he says, so if the emotions are true, that's much more important to me than whether I've really captured the actual truth of a moment. And for me, that I feel exactly the same way.
Yes.
You know, if the emotions are true, the emotional arc, the emotional journey of the characters is true, that's much more important than whether, you know, the Gurkhas were really sent to Northern Ireland in 1922.
Yeah. Or whether bus 34 leaves from this corner or another corner. Or
exactly.
I think it was Margaret Atwood was taken to task once in the Writers' Festival. I think it was her, about some inaccuracy that she... And her response really was, whether she said it's bloody fiction, but she said, it's fiction. What do you expect? Which is basically, you know...
Exactly. Sort of thing, you're not... I mean, a historian could be taken to task.
Of course, yeah. But you're not.
But I'm not a historian.
No. Just sort of apart from your books, I've noticed that you've got a blog called The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. Is that very important to you? Perhaps you can say something about what you mean about the psychopathology of everyday life. Why do you call it that?
Well, it's... I remember reading this. The Psychopathology of Everyday Life is, I think, one of Freud's... I think it's his book that was... it was the first book of his that was translated into English, if I remember correctly. And Freud talked about how in everyday life and every action that people do, there's this interesting psychopathology behind everything that they do. And the more you examine even the most mundane actions, there's this whole story behind it.
Yeah.
And I love that idea, somebody just sitting having a coffee, looking out the window, there's all these thoughts going on in their head. And Joyce did this in Ulysses. He thought, well, there's all these interesting so-called mundane actions of people, but actually underneath it, there's this entire mental universe. There's this river of thoughts and ideas. And I thought, well, if I'm doing my blog, you know, I can just do these things that occur to me, just these things, ideas and stuff that's going on in my life. And actually, as the blog is involved, I've gone away from that concept. When I first started off, I'll talk about my inner life and what's going on inside me. And I found that my inner life wasn't that interesting. that it really wasn't as fascinating
as you thought.
As I thought. So I thought, well, I'll just start doing. And then I just thought, well, what's more interesting to me is how I react to external factors. Yeah. So it's basically I just do my book reviews or film reviews. And I review books for The Age sometimes. And after I publish them in The Age, I'll publish them on the blog or I'll just react. I mean, I'll talk about books or films or.
It seems to involve quite a bit of research, though. It's not just, you know, your opinion about something or other. You know, it seems to sort of go quite deep. It's just there's quite a bit of research involved.
You fall down the Wikipedia rabbit hole. I mean, that's the problem, you just go,
that leads to that.
The last post that I was doing was, what was the last thing I did? The last thing I did was my friend Alicia is running for Professor of Poetry at Oxford.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember I was going to do quite a short post about that. Mm. And I remember spending an entire day just reading about all the other poets up for the job, reading their poetry, reading where they came from. And then I fell down this Wikipedia rabbit hole where I was looking up all the previous poets and who had done the job. And it was fascinating. Mm. It was fascinating. And then I thought, oh my God, I spent 4 hours on this. What the hell? So then I very quickly wrote a blog post and I said, no, I have some real work to do that I actually get paid for. So I better go do that instead, yeah.
And just referring to one, you said something before about you not being the sort of person who thinks of the smart remark at the time, that sort of later. But there's one that was very amusing by one of your blog entries where you were cycling without a helmet. And you came up with what I thought was a perfect line.
Well,
it was
actually,
very funny, but that, it was a
that, again,
line.
That was not rehearsed because. I'll tell you the whole story for that. 2 years ago, I had been cycling on the St. Kilda cycle path. And I hadn't been wearing a helmet. It was a lovely sunny day, and I go really slow. I have only one gear bike, and I go 3 kilometers an hour in this ancient Indian one gear bike. And this guy zoomed past me, and he said, "Oi, put your helmet on!" And I had nothing to say. And so for 2 years, I've been sitting steaming and trying to think, what would I have said? What could I have said?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so then I thought,
disappoint me now.
Yeah, no. So then I thought to myself, you know what I should have said?
Yeah.
I should have said to him, well, actually, I'm practicing civil disobedience. And so for the next couple of times that I've been cycling without my helmet, I'm going to, you know, if somebody says something to me, I'm ready. I'm ready for a line. And nobody said anything until about 2 weeks ago when this guy comes down to me and he said, "Oi, where's your helmet?" And then I said, "Well, actually, I'm practicing civil disobedience." And he said, "What?" I said, "I'm practicing civil disobedience." And he said, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "As in Thoreau." And he'd never heard of Thoreau. So then we had this increasingly angry confrontation. And then I detailed the whole dialogue on the blog. And
with that wonderful line that you have the face of a policeman.
Yeah, no, that wasn't original line. That's unlike me. But I did.
That was fantastic.
Because he said to me, he's really getting on my nerves. He said, we'd had this quite angry conversation. He said, "You know, I could report you to the police." And then I said to him, "I wouldn't be surprised if you reported me to the police. You have an informer's face." And he said, "What?" And he said, "You have the face of a police informer." And then he just got really furious.
This sounds like Sean Duffy writing. He's poked through some code somehow.
I know. Although Sean Duffy loves police informers because they're the only people that give them information.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was quite funny. And I thought, well, this is a blog post.
That's right. Yeah.
Something has actually happened to me.
Not fiction.
No, nothing ever happens. But this actually is something that happens. So I put that in.
Now, I'll probably just finish up by just asking you, because I think I read somewhere that you're not inclined to write Australian crime fiction, because you said somewhere that there's so many Australian crime writers doing it, but I can't believe you wouldn't live in St Kilda and, you know, there'd be something sort of in the back of your mind there, a bit of
St
Kilda crime.
There are other St Kilda books, St Kilda Blues, I mean, St Kilda gets pretty well covered in crime fiction, and I still feel I don't really understand Australia. I mean, I've only been here like, almost 7 years now, actually. But I still get caught out in dialogue and the lingo that people use. But you know, now that I've finished up, or I'm finishing up with the Duffy series, maybe I'll. I mean, it is a very interesting neighbourhood, St Kilda, because you've got that mix of the really, really wealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just down the road in Brighton, you've got those $20 million mansions. I mean, Shane Warne lives about 2 kilometres that way. He's gesturing south with his thumb.
Yeah.
Or he lived there with Liz Hurley until he sold out.
Yeah.
And just that way, there's like, you know, government housing, and there's homeless people on Ackland Street.
A lot of drugs.
There's a lot of, I mean, just around the corner from here is Grey Street, which has been a famous street of prostitution for 120 years.
That's right. Yeah.
And a prostitute was actually murdered on Grey Street, or just Grey Street last summer.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is definitely a fascinating place, and it's this weird eclectic mix. And so if I was going to write an Australian crime novel, I would definitely set it here.
Yeah.
Because I know it really well, and it's really, really interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
And I actually think I'd set it in East St Kilda. Because East St Kilda is even more interesting.
Yeah.
Because you have that big Jewish neighbourhood as well. And
lots of things merging together.
They've got lots of things merging together over there. I mean, it's just, it's a really interesting.
You couldn't have Sean Duffy move to St Kilda.
Oh, God, that'd be great. If he lives, maybe that's where he'll retire to.
Yeah, what an idea.
How old would he be now? He'd be what?
He'd be ready for retirement?
I suppose he'd be in his 60s now, wouldn't he, if he's alive?
Thinking about retirement.
Yeah, he could be an old codger.
That's right. Yeah.
Tramping the streets.
Pushing your shopping trolley around.
Yeah. solving problems. I do like that. I do like in crime fiction when it's the person you least expect. I love that in Miss Marple.
Yeah.
When you know, all this stuff's going on in the drawing rooms, and there's this little old lady in the corner.
Yeah.
And no one thinks about her.
No.
Who's, oh, she's totally harmless. She's this dim-witted little old lady with her knitting and her cup of tea.
Yeah.
And she's got the finest mind of all of them. And she's the best observer. She's the greatest mind. And that's why I loved about Columbo as well.
Yes.
Columbo is so shabby. And, you know, he's all over the place. He's forgetful.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dripping his cigar ash. And all these, you know, rich people living in Hollywood, they don't even consider him. They just go, oh, my God, who's this schlub that's come in from the... He's not... But... Columbo's smarter than all of them.
Yeah.
Like, he's got this brilliant brain. And I do love that when the external, you know, character is, you know, down at heel or broken or...
Some sort of an outsider.
Some sort of an outsider that you never think about. I think that's so much more interesting. Mm. I'm not knocking Lee Child, but, you know, Jack Reacher is the 6'5", 250-pound... you know, bodybuilder who's, you know, can kill somebody with, you know, to me that's not as interesting as the little old frail lady who traps you by thinking.
Mm. Mm.
She outthinks you. She outgenerals you with her thoughts.
Yeah.
To me that's much scarier than, you know, for Jack Reacher, you know, if you've got a car, you can outrun him, but you can never outrun Miss Marple because she will not only outthink you, she'll figure out where you're running to.
Yes,
and she'll have the police waiting there to arrest you. I love that stuff. And I loved it in Columbo. It's such a real shame that Peter Falk is dead and that's off the air. Because there's nothing like that, really.
No. I loved it. It might be over to you to...
It's definitely time for a reboot. They'd have to get an actor with his charisma, though.
Mm.
He's such charisma when he comes onto the screen.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Falk. He was amazing.
Yeah.
But I loved it when they would show. I think that's why they started every episode, isn't it? They would show you how he did it.
Mm.
They would always show you how the criminal did it, and it was never a whodunit.
No.
It was how Columbo tracked them. How he sprung the trap.
Yeah.
And that was such a terrific... And I don't think there's any programs that do that anymore, is there? Really? It's always there's always the element of the whodunit now.
That's right, yeah.
And even when they have... Even Sherlock.
Mm.
When he's young and he's handsome, he's got a great mind, but he's young, he's skinny, he's handsome.
Yeah, yeah, he's so, going for him. He's not the outsider.
Yeah, he's not really the outsider, you know, and he, you know, and his brother's like this, the head of the Secret Service or something. But I guess that's a hard sell on TV to young executives. Oh yeah, we're going to cast an ugly actor. He's going to be old, and the audience, he's going to be odd, and the audience is going to like him.
Yeah.
What?
But then look at the characters in The Bridge. I mean... you know, I can't remember her name, but you know, the Swedish.
Yeah, that's right.
She's definitely an outsider.
That's right. And I think in Danish and Swedish TV, they're a bit more willing to cast more interesting looking actors.
That's right, yeah. Not so Hollywoodish.
Than they are in British TV and in American TV. I started watching this program, I don't know if you've seen it, called The Game. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't.
It's this spy drama set in England, and it sounds like a really good concept, a spy drama set in England in the 70s.
Yeah.
But I watched the first episode, and the male lead looks like a young Byron.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he's like 24, he's got this perfect hair, he's thin, he's handsome, he's got these piercing eyes. You just go, really? Has he had such a difficult life? You know, I just go, you know, could you not have cast someone a little bit more, like they've had a few tough breaks? You know, it's hard to root for something like that. It looks like, you know, they've sailed through their existence, you know, without any problems.
Okay, well, look, we could sit here in front of the fire in St Kilda on a rainy morning for a long, long time, but I think, you know, perhaps we might finish there. Adrian, thank you very, very much for your time. It's been delightful to meet up with you and talk to you about your books.
It was brilliant talking to you.
Thanks.
Cheers,
a lot.
Mate.